Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Bose Corporation against Consumers Union. Mr. Harkin, I think you may proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case presents the question whether, when constitutional rights are involved, appellate judges who did not hear the witnesses testify can conduct a de novo review of the cold printed record of a lengthy bench trial unrestrained by the clearly erroneous requirements of Rule 52A or the due process requirements of the Fifth Amendment, and reverse the findings of the U.S. District Court judge who heard the witnesses testify. In 1967, Dr. Amar G. Bose, a professor of electrical engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, invented the 901 loudspeaker system. The design of the 901 loudspeaker system was based on 12 years of research at MIT. In 1968, Bose began marketing the loudspeaker, and the 901 loudspeaker met with success in the marketplace. The district court had found that the Bose 901 had received the best reviews which had been given to a loudspeaker product. Then in 1970, respondent, Consumers Union, published an article entitled Loudspeakers in its monthly magazine, Consumer Reports, purporting to rate 24 medium-priced loudspeakers based on tests and measurements conducted in its laboratories by its engineers, including the use of panelists. The article also reported on tests conducted of some higher-priced loudspeakers under the heading Some Loudspeakers of Special Interest. One of these loudspeakers of special interest was the Bose 901 loudspeaker system. The district court found that the article as a whole disparaged the 901 loudspeaker system. In particular, the district court found that one statement was actionable in that it was false and disparaging. Based on observations of panelists playing recordings through the Bose 901 loudspeaker system, the article reported, and I quote, "Worse, individual instruments heard through the Bose system tended to wander about the room." The district court judge then determined that Bose was a public figure and would be required to meet the actual malice test of New York Times, and therefore had to prove that CU knew of the falsity of the statement by clear and convincing evidence. What the district court judge did was to focus on the knowledge of the author of the statement, A.L. Seligson, who was the engineer in charge of conducting the tests and who actually wrote the article. He was one of the two panelists who participated in the test upon which the false statement was based. Well, when the article came out, Bose complained promptly. They tried to set up a meeting as soon as possible with CU. Finally, in June of 1970, the meeting was held. And Dr. Bose went to this meeting. He told the people there, look, it's scientifically impossible for a loudspeaker to make instruments wander about the room when heard through a loudspeaker. And so he asked for a demonstration there. They had the loudspeakers there. It would have taken a half hour to set up the demonstration, according to the testimony of Seligson, who was at the meeting. But its associate technical director, Monty Florman, refused to put on the demonstration. Dr. Bose again asked for the demonstration, and again the demonstration was refused. So Dr. Bose asked Mr. Seligson to please identify the recordings that had been used to observe these strange phenomena of instruments wandering about the room. Seligson said that he would supply those recordings, but he never did. And therefore, as the district court found at the conclusion of the damage trial, Bose could not refute the false statement by demonstrating to customers and dealers that, in fact, instruments heard through the Bose system did not wander about the room when using the same recordings that Consumers Union had allegedly used during the test. Well, Bose sought a retraction. It was refused. And so Bose sued in 1971. Finally, in 1980, there was a trial on the liability question first. And lo and behold, at the trial, we now learn why CU refused to demonstrate the loudspeakers or to identify the recordings. The reason? Because at the trial it came out that the panelists never heard instruments through the Bose system that tended to wander about the room. Now, the false and disparaging statement was based on a special listening test conducted in the special listening room that Consumers Union had. It was a room about 18 feet wide and about 24 feet long. At one end of the room...
Mr. Hyken?
Yes, Your Honor.
As to the disparaging nature of the language which you just referred to, both the district court and the court of appeals ruled in your client's favor on that point, didn't
they? That is correct, Your Honor. Yes. Thank you. And they had set these loudspeakers at the end of the room, about 10 feet apart. And supposedly they played recordings through them. At the trial, by the way, you probably know what stereo sound is, that you have a speaker at the left and you have a speaker at the right. Just as in this courtroom, to the left of the bench, there is a column of three speakers, and similarly to the right.
You don't sound like you're on stereo.
That's probably because we're sending the signals in phase to both channels simultaneously, so you get mono, right? But in stereo, you're exactly right, though, because now you're observing what happens when both left and right loudspeakers receive sound energy of the same intensity. The sound appears to come from the middle. Now, if you were to turn down the loudspeaker at your left, you'd hear the sound coming from the right. And if you turn down the intensity of the sound at the right, you'd hear the sound coming from the left. And that's just what happens in a stereo system. Gradually, they raise the level in the left and then in the right, and the net impact on you is that you hear instruments that come from various points between the two loudspeakers. And that is normal stereo sound. You can try it at home on your own stereo system by taking your balance control and moving it to the left and then to the right, and you'll get the same effect. And that's basically what Seligson and Lefko testified they heard at the special listening test. Now, they said that they observed movement on only one instrument, and that one instrument was the violin sounds. And they said that the movement was restricted to movement between the left and the right loudspeakers. It did not wander about the room. Now, during cross-examination, Seligson and Lefko each drew on large charts exactly what they heard during the special listening test. And reproductions of those drawings are included in petitioner's brief after page 12. One of them is plaintiff's exhibit 29. That was the drawing that Seligson made. The loudspeakers are represented as small pentagons at one end of the wall, and they look much like a home plate at a baseball game. Seligson drew a red line between the loudspeakers with arrowheads at each end, and the various violin sounds came from various points on that line between the loudspeakers and from nowhere else. Lefko drew something somewhat similar on plaintiff's exhibit 35, which is a small red rectangle between the left and right loudspeakers. And the sounds came from that region and nowhere else, and only on the violin. The piano sounds did not wander, they testify. Well, on cross-examination, after that drawing was completed, Seligson was asked, why did you use the words tended to wander about the room to describe what you had drawn on the board? And Seligson replied, well, about meant to me mean about the rear wall between the speakers. And what happened? The district court made specific findings. He said, look, people would not be surprised by movement along the wall between the two speakers. That's normal stereo sound, basically. Movement throughout the other areas of the room was not to be expected. Such a bizarre effect is contrary to what listeners are accustomed to and would be objectionable to most listeners. Now, and the district court, of course, heard Seligson testify on 6 trial days, and he found that Seligson's testimony on about the room, meaning along the wall between speakers, not credible based on his demeanor and Seligson's testimony. In addition, the district court found that the testimony of CU's technical director, who at the time of the tests was associate technical director, was wholly untrustworthy and not credible. Well, at the conclusion of the damage trial, there was an appeal. And the Court of Appeals, as Mr. Justice Rehnquist noticed, found the statement disparaging and assumed it was false. But then the Court of Appeals went on and said, now what we must do is we must perform a de novo review of the record, not limited by the clearly erroneous requirements of Rule 52A. Now, in the course of this review, the Court of Appeals did not mention, under the heading review, the state of mind of the author Seligson, but instead it focused on the editorial review. And in connection with this editorial review, it relied on the testimony of Monty Florman, the associate technical director, whose testimony was found by the district court to be wholly untrustworthy and not credible. In making reference to, well, maybe C was only guilty of using imprecise language, it appeared to be relying on the testimony of Seligson to the effect, well, what did you want me to say instead of wandered about the room? Would you have been happier if I'd have said across the wall? I think not. What the Court of Appeals also did is it said, It's not enough for Bose to prove actual malice, according to the New York Times test, but Bose had to prove evidence of actual malice by showing evidence of negligence, motive, and intent. And the Court of Appeal said, well, we're just unable to find clear and convincing proof that Consumers Union knew that the false and disparaging statement that it published was false. Well, there are a number of errors in the way the Court of Appeals conducted its review. First of all, it made a de novo review of the record to determine if the evidence was clear and convincing to it, not whether it could have been clear and convincing to the United States District Court judge who tried the case, who actually heard the witnesses testify, who was able to observe their demeanor, who, when he was troubled on a point, was able to question the witness and clarify that point.
Mr. May I ask you, Your Honor. What do you think the Court of Appeals' job was?
We have set that out in our reply brief, I think, beginning on page 4. Basically, we suggest that the thing to do for a Court of Appeals is, one, look at the findings of fact that the district court judge filed. Do those findings of fact support the judgment? Basically,
Are you suggesting there that the New York Times standard does not require any different review of factual findings than in any other kind of case? Court of Appeals, they said this is a First Amendment case,
yes,
under New York Times against Sullivan. We have a special duty to look at the record more closely than we normally would. Do you disagree with that?
No, we don't. In New York Times, it said that the type of review we conduct is an independent examination of the whole record, and it's the whole record. That means...
So that to the extent that the court did independently examine the whole record, it did the right thing here.
If it did that in conducting a de novo review...
That part was right.
That was conducting a de novo review, in effect disregarding the findings of fact, is not correct, and that's not what the Court of Appeals did. It did not examine the evidence to see if the evidence, if believed by the district court, could support the findings of fact. That was to be the second point of our suggested test, that after you find the findings of fact that he found support the judgment, you want to examine the evidence to see if the evidence, if believed by the district court judge, would support those findings, and the district court judge has, in a New York Times case, has found it supported by clear and convincing evidence, then you can affirm the judgment. And there are...
Well, let me try.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you think the court should have been bound by the findings of fact?
Yes, Your Honor, unless clearly erroneous.
And he shouldn't read the record.
No, the Court of Appeals should read the record, Your Honor.
Well, they could set him aside if they found him clearly erroneous.
Absolutely, yes, Your Honor.
But you don't think they could set him aside by relying on testimony from a witness that the district court said he didn't believe?
Absolutely not. Absolutely wrong. That is one of the things...
So you think the Court of Appeals is at least bound by... If they can tell by the district court's rulings on credibility.
That is correct, Your Honor. Absolutely bound by the rulings on credibility, unless the findings on credibility are clearly erroneous.
Well, how can you tell that?
I don't know.
If a judge says, I think you're lying,
I
don't
know. You
don't
make findings on credibility.
No,
the judge doesn't say, I disbelieve this witness because of factors A, B,
no.
C, D.
But if the only evidence in the case is deposition testimony, I suppose the district judge hasn't got any leverage on the Court of Appeals.
I think that's fair to say, Your Honor. But, of course, that's not this case because
I know, but
I think you're correct on that point. So
I take it you're not asking us to cut back on the New York Times in any way.
That is correct. It's not necessary. At the district court level, we said that it wasn't necessary for the district court even to determine whether Bose was a public figure because we could prove by clear and convincing evidence that there was actual malice. And I was going on to the third point, which was that the Court of Appeals must not make de novo findings of fact based on the cold printed record. And the fourth point, which really has already been brought out here, is it must not rely on testimony which the district court judge found to be not credible. And that's what...
May I just ask, because I'm really not sure, and are you asking us to decide any novel proposition of law, or are you just basically asking us to take a good hard look at the record here and be sure that the Court of Appeals did its job correctly?
I think that we're asking you to take a look and see that the Court of Appeal, whether the Court of Appeals did the
so
job.
There really isn't any question of law of any particular significance at stake.
I think there is. I think.
And if there is, what is it? That's what I'm trying to find
out.
What
is that the Court of Appeals said it was not bound by the clearly erroneous rule of Rule 52A. And we submit that that is inconsistent with the trilogy of cases that this court decided in 1982, beginning with the Pullman Standard v. Swint, followed by Inwood Laboratories, or Ives Laboratories, the Inwood Laboratories.
You say that, therefore, the Court of Appeals could not have, should not have purported to make de novo findings.
Absolutely. That is correct. And
what
and
do
it
we,
did.
And that, and what do we do with the testimony of the witness that the judge said was incredible?
Not credible?
Yeah.
Disregard it. You have to disregard
can
it.
Can we read it?
Oh, you can read it, but I think you have
but
to disregard
it. That's all.
Yes.
We can't do anything about it.
No.
If we'll read it.
I think that it should be disregarded when it's not credible. Now, another mistake that the...
Well, what happens if we think it's credible?
That's not your function.
I mean, suppose the testimony of the witness says it is now 10 minutes past 2.
Yeah.
And the judge said that's incredible.
Then that's...
But I can't recognize that.
No, I think you may well find the judge's ruling on that point being clearly erroneous under that circumstance. But... Anyway, focusing, if I may, I'd like to focus on another important area where the Court of Appeals missed the boat. That is that it did not consider this court's decision in the Cantrell versus Forest City Publishing Company case. Because in that case, it said that knowledge of the author of falsity is attributable to the publisher when the author is performing this writing in the course of his employment. And the Court of Appeals did not cite it and instead focused a great deal of attention on the editorial review, and most of this editorial review evidence was based on the discredited testimony of Monty Florman. So it's our position that, and the, what the district court judge did, it said, I don't have to look at what the editorial review policy was, because if the editorial people got a false state from respondent's engineer to begin with, is all they could do was trim it up, and it would still be a false statement. And this was a situation of not a music critic. This was a statement that was written by an experienced engineer who had 25 years of experience in testing loudspeakers that time. Well, there is the important aspect in review also of the opportunity to evaluate the credibility of witnesses. And what is our device for testing credibility of witnesses? It's cross-examination. And this court has regularly held that there is a constitutional right to have cross-examination of witnesses. But what is the measuring stick to determine the impact of the cross-examination? The measuring device that we use in the trial courts is the district court judge in the case of a bench trial or the jury in the case of a jury trial. And so, if the Court of Appeals is allowed to rely on testimony that was destroyed on cross-examination, then petitioner has been deprived of a property right without due process of law.
Well, of course, the Court of Appeals expressly said they weren't reviewing credibility determinations.
They said they weren't, but then they went ahead. If you look at what they actually did, and they, so far as we can see, they do not mention under the heading review of the impact of the testimony of Seligson, of what he knew. He testified as to what he actually heard. And he used language of such a nature that it was perfectly clear that he knew the difference between sounds that move back and forth between left and right loudspeakers, which was normal stereo sound, and this bizarre and grotesque sound that was reported in the article of interest of instruments that tended to wander about the other areas of the room, which the district court judge found to be bizarre and grotesque. The test that we have proposed here, and it's in the reply brief and I've mentioned it, is consistent with the requirements of Rule 52A, with the First Amendment, with the Fifth Amendment. It promotes the confidence of litigants in our judicial system. It reduces appeals. It allows courts of appeals to spend their time on ruling on questions of law so that they can give guidance to us lawyers and we can advise our clients so as to stay out of litigation. That is, it promotes certainty in our pre-litigation conduct. There is no constitutional right to lie, and that is what Consumers Union has done here.
Comment on the Baumgartner case? I don't believe you've cited it.
No.
It's cited extensively by your opposition.
May I comment on it?
Yes.
After, in my rebuttal period, because I'd like to save 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you don't mind.
I do want to hear from you on it, because yes. I find nothing in your briefs about it.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Pullen.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. 13 years after publication of the disputed article, and after the district court had explicitly rejected numerous charges of product disparagement and bias against Consumers Union, and had upheld CU's good faith and integrity against every attack leveled against it, this dispute centers around the alleged slip of a single preposition, the word about, as expressed by Consumers Union in giving its subjective impression of instruments heard through these novel, unique, and unconventional loudspeakers.
Mr. Pallette,
yes.
I didn't understand you to challenge in your brief the finding of the district court upheld by the Court of Appeals that CU's article was in fact disparaging. Are you challenging it now?
We do indeed challenge that. We think when properly and fairly read that it is not disparaging. It
you
may
didn't
be
make
criticism.
Any, you didn't cross petition.
No, Your Honor, we did not.
So we judge,
I do
this
believe,
case, we judge this case on the basis that it was disparaging.
Yes.
Well, I do believe we raised that point in the course of our argument in the petition, although not as a separate point.
So you mean you're relying on the proposition if you can't sustain your judgment on the ground given, maybe you can on this one?
That's right. That's right. We believe when properly read, fairly, not...
So if we agree with your adversary on the other point, you want us then to turn to whether or not this was disparaging?
Yes. We would welcome such an opportunity and a look at the article in its proper context. We believe that the trivial...
I gather you argued below that it was not disparaging.
Oh, yes. Very clearly. This trivial difference between words found actionable and not accentuates the substantial risks which even a responsible publisher can face in expressing subjective judgments, even in the form of mild criticism. We respectfully submit that reversal was proper under any standard of appellate review. The issues at stake here are important and significant. They are whether we remain committed to the preservation of First Amendment principles woven into defamation law in Times v. Sullivan. As the district court ruling so graphically demonstrates, those protections afforded to the press in a public figure libel suit that the plaintiff show falsity and show with convincing clarity that the publisher knowingly lied or in fact had serious doubts of accuracy are fragile indeed and subject to facile or distorted fact-finding. Without the continued ability of our appellate courts to exercise independent constitutional judgment to determine for themselves whether constitutional rules here have been constitutionally applied to undisputed facts, the breathing space which this court has held necessary if the freedoms of speech are to survive will be lost.
Well, is it your submission that a clearly erroneous standard just doesn't apply in a First Amendment case?
It does not apply in any event to the ultimate fact, the question of law, the conclusion of actual
matters. Does it apply at all?
If it applies at all, it would apply only to historical facts.
Yeah. Well, let's just assume for the moment that you probably won't agree with it. Let's just assume that knowledge, the question of knowledge, is a historical fact. Would you say that the clearly erroneous standard would apply to that?
Are we talking in the context of a defamation suit?
Where the claim is that the person who wrote the article or made the statement, the defamatory statement, knew that it was false, just knew. Let's assume that's a historical fact. Would the clearly erroneous standard apply to that?
No, because that is the ultimate conclusion drawn from historical facts. I don't understand that as being a historical fact. But if it were,
you would think that the clearly erroneous standard applied to it.
No, because I believe, as this court recently held in Connick v. Myers just this past April, that the inquiry into the protected status of speech is a matter of law and
I take it your submission is that the clearly erroneous standard just doesn't apply at all.
It does not apply at all when we are
in the First Amendment case.
That is right. And this court has made that crystal clear.
Well, what principle of the First Amendment suggests that it's desirable to allow a court of appeals, such as it did in this case, to simply second-guess a trial judge's finding that a witness whom the trial judge heard testify was not credible?
Well, with all due deference, Justice Rehnquist, the facts in this case, as you have posed them, are not as they occurred. The trial judge in this case plainly and clearly articulated his reason, his sole rationale for the finding of so-called incredibility, which was that the author was too intelligent to have made an honest mistake. That is not a credibility finding. That is an erroneous application of law.
Well, each is entitled to his own opinion.
Sounds like a play on words to me.
The publisher before the court here is Consumers Union of the United States. It is the nation's leading and most prestigious not-for-profit testing organization. For more than 47 years, it has published the monthly magazine Consumer Reports. In May of 1970, Consumers Union included in a survey of 24 loudspeaker models a 7-paragraph evaluation of the unique, unconventional Bose Model 901 loudspeaker system.
I suppose by the same token, if it's such an authoritative voice, it is capable of inflicting great damage.
Well, Your Honor, the facts in this case do not show great damage. Within a year or so after publication of the article, the Bose 901, according to the record, was either first or second in total dollar volume sales in the country. Thus, if Consumers Union may have a great effect, it certainly wasn't a negative effect in this case. Indeed, the review was in part complimentary and in part cautionary. It attempted to put into words the author's aesthetic perception of a uniquely subjective impression of an amorphous phenomenon that all parties, including the court, had difficulty in describing with precision. As noted, the review's evaluation opened with praise of the plaintiff's product. It termed the Bose 901 considerably more spacious and reverberant than conventional speakers. It said that the effect was rather dramatic and was felt from any listening position. After judging various qualities of the Bose system, indeed, the article concluded not by recommending against purchase of the Bose, but by directly telling its readers, "We think the Bose system is so unusual that a prospective buyer must listen to it and judge it for himself." The article, in addition to the concededly complimentary findings and the encouragement to try the product, noted that it was more difficult to pinpoint the location of instruments with the Bose than with standard speaker systems. That is a finding that was not found false in the district court. In specifying what it meant about the localization problems, the review went on to say, in a single sentence containing the only phrase found actionable by the district court, "Worse, individual instruments heard through the Bose system seem to grow to gigantic proportions and tended to wander about the room." The immediately following sentence, the author put both the size and location of the described perceptions into context. It was written, "For instance, a violin appeared to be 10 feet wide and a piano stretched from wall to wall." And then the author minimized his judgments by stating, "With orchestral music, such effects seem inconsequential, but we think they might become annoying when listening to soloists." The district court found defamation, disparagement, only by breaking the sentence in two, by parsing it artificially. That portion of the sentence which referred to instruments seeming to grow to gigantic proportions was held not proven false. The court then isolated and wrenched from its context the remainder of the phrase, that instruments tended to wander about the room. As noted, the judge found that subjective perception was better expressed as sound which tended to wander about or along the wall rather than about the room. It ignored the word "tended" in the disputed phrase itself. The district court dismissed the following sentence, which placed the effects along the wall, by saying that sentence would not thus be understood by any reasonable reader. And the phrase was found by the district court to attribute bizarre and grotesque effects to the product, despite the plain absence of any such words in the article, and the plain language in the article that the effects were inconsequential with orchestral music and only might become annoying when listening to soloists. Having found the disputed phrase to be false, the court disregarded the author's testimony to his good faith belief that the words accurately described what he had perceived.
Do you think falsity is a mixed question of fact and law, or is it a historical fact, or is it a straight question of law?
I think falsity is at least a mixed question of law and fact, if not a pure question of law.
Right. Why would it have any legal implications rather than factual implications?
Falsity?
Yes.
Because, again, it implies and implicates First Amendment freedoms, the right to free speech and free press.
Well, but why does that convert something that would otherwise be a factual question into a legal question?
Because, as Justice Frankfurter noted in the Watts case, an issue of fact is a coat of many colors. An issue of fact involves a conclusion drawn from uncontroverted happenings, and that conclusion implicates fundamental freedoms, it is a mixed question of law and fact, and not to be treated as an ordinary fact subject to the same limitations that more pedestrian fact-finding might involve.
What's your authority for that statement? What case from this court?
With respect to the issue of falsity?
Yes.
Each case in this court that has considered libel judgments have done it on the issue of actual malice, I believe,
yes.
Justice Rehnquist. I don't believe there is direct authority on the issue of falsity.
Well, if there's disputed, if there's a statement that a certain object is red and then somebody else claims it's black and the district judge listens to all the witnesses and finds that, well, the object is black, it wasn't red at all. Is that a mixed question of law and fact to find that it's that an assertion that the object is red is false? Isn't that a historical fact?
That may be a historical fact, yes, Your Honor. But what is not a historical fact is the ultimate conclusion of actual malice.
Well, I understand that.
And but finding...
What about the issue of disparagement, the holding of that this was a disparaging statement? What is that? Is that an issue of law or fact?
I believe that's an issue of law, but that is a legal standard which must be measured by...
Well, can we decide whether or not this was disparaging without addressing the question of what the nature of the review may be?
Yes, I believe you can by reading the article.
And if we were to agree with you that it was not disparaging, that would be the end of the case without having to address the other issue.
For sure.
We could. That's on your... That's just another reason you say to affirm.
Yes.
It isn't an issue that would be involved if we just dealt with the issues that were presented on certiorari.
No, it would not. No, it would not.
Would you refresh my recollection? Am I correct in recalling that the actual holding of the Court of Appeals was limited to the actual malice issue, that there had been a failure of proof on that issue?
That is correct.
So they didn't really reach the question whether it was fact or mixed question or on falsity or any of these other points.
No. Although the Court of Appeals expressed doubt as to whether the statement was false, for the purposes of its opinion, it assumed that the statement was factual and that it was false.
And that it was disparaging.
And that it was... No, it did state separately...
It agreed that it was disparaging.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is correct. Although
but
not...
But their holding, which... And the question whether it's fact or mixed question and so forth... related solely to the malice issue.
That is correct.
Yes, but aren't there two ways of finding malice? One is to find that there was a knowing falsehood, and the other is that there's a reckless disregard for truth.
Yes.
And malice is just a code word for either one of those. I mean, if you find a knowing falsehood, you've satisfied the burden of proof under New York Times, haven't you?
Yes, you do, but
so
it is
malice
that standard.
Is that, you really ought to look behind what the particular finding is. Reckless disregard for truth might be one thing, but knowing falsehoods another.
Well, I think for these purposes, they are both the same thing. For the purposes of independent appellate review.
Well, I know
review.
That's your submission.
Fact or law?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Fact or law? As Justice White has just
that is right. Me.
Which is it?
It is law. It is law, or it is an ultimate fact in which a standard of constitutionality...
Then you don't accept his translation, if it's that, malice is just a code word describing either one of those two concepts.
No. Malice is a legal construct derived specifically from the Constitution.
Well, yes, but malice is defined in the New York Times as either not knowing falsehood or reckless disregard.
It is also defined as a constitutional standard.
Well, it may be, but it's not separate from knowledge or reckless disregard.
Well, that is the point, Your Honor, that you cannot separate the constitutional standard from the finding of fact. And as the footnote in New York Times in dismissing the Seventh Amendment arguments against independent appellate review, pointed out when a federal question, a constitutional right, is so intermingled with a finding of fact that it is necessary in order to pass on the legal question to analyze the facts, that the court must look at the issue independently. And that is
what that applies to federal courts as well, where you have this Rule 52?
Yes. I think it applies more so to federal courts because this court's and appellate court's corrective authority over the lower federal courts is larger and less restrictive than it is with respect to state courts or state court juries.
The way you put it, you would think that the rule you're talking about applies whenever there's any constitutional issue involved. Whenever there's an issue of so-called constitutional fact, the Rule 52 is just beside the point.
I don't know if we have to go that far, certainly not in this case.
Well, that was the way you put it.
In this case, the precedents in this court are clear with respect to the court's duty, mandate, as to how it shall look at the conclusion of the lower court. It must do so independently because of the nature of the right involved. And it is particularly apposite and appropriate here because of the high nature of the standard of proof, that it be clear and convincing. If I might, just for a few moments, Your Honors, turn to what we consider and what we have described as the undisputed, established, or record evidence in this case, because we believe that when looked at fairly and properly and not mischaracterized, that evidence shows that the actual malice finding was not only without support, but it was in contradiction to the record evidence. Looked at, it is plain that prior to publication, Consumers Union carried out a lengthy, original, extensive research and editorial process, that it contained numerous checks for review and accuracy, that the research and editing process were adhered to closely. There was no departure from reasonable journalism standards. The authors were experienced and expert in loudspeaker testing. Mr. Seligson has 25 years of experience. He is highly respected. He has extensive educational, engineering, and journalistic backgrounds.
Mr. Paula, may I ask a question that we think goes to this part of your argument? Your legal position is that the Court of Appeals must look more closely at the record than in a normal case. Now, when we're reviewing a Court of Appeals, do we have the same obligation to make a rather fresh examination of the record, so we have to have the same detailed understanding of the nuances of the facts that we expect the Court of Appeals to have in order to decide it?
I think you have the same obligation to make an independent constitutional judgment, to accept the facts in the record which were admitted, established, or undisputed, and independently to determine for yourself whether those facts, as found, can constitutionally support an actual malice finding.
We need three de novo reviews of this record, in effect.
Well, it is not a de novo review of the record in the sense that the court is going to make independent fact-finding, find new facts.
We should do whatever the Court of Appeals did.
Yeah.
The Court of Appeals did not.
Well, I know, but whatever they did, we can do and should do.
Yes.
And if they were remiss, then we should do the job over.
Yes. Because, as this Court has stated, that is its obligation in such cases, not merely to elaborate constitutional principles, but to make sure that they don't intrude upon First Amendment in considering the facts.
The Court said that, of course, in the New York Times, but that was in the context of the review of a state Supreme Court decision, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
And you don't think there's any difference when it comes, as this one does?
I think if there is any difference, that this court is even freer in such a case. Rule 52, as noted, is a rule of federal civil procedure, and it is not of the same magnitude and order as the Constitution. I think it would be an anomalous situation if this court had greater authority to review facts found in a state court than it did in a federal court.
Well, there happens to be the rule of 52. It's got the position of a statute, and unless it's unconstitutional, it binds us with respect to facts. You think it's unconstitutional, Rule 52, in the First Amendment case?
No, I don't think it's unconstitutional because I don't believe it applies. And I don't believe that Rule 52
certainly
is ever...
It does on its face. It applies to all fact-finding.
All findings of fact, except questions of law, which actual malice is, or a mixed question of law and fact implicating a constitutional standard, which this also is.
A so-called element fact.
Yes.
In your view, does the appellate court's job the same regardless of whether the First Amendment right was sustained or rejected in the trial court? If you had won in the trial court instead of losing, would your opponent have been entitled to the same broad review that you claim to be entitled to?
In this case, I believe not, because this is not a defamation case, a libel suit brought by an individual plaintiff, where there may be, although I state this only arguendo, a more balanced weighing of the rights involved, the reputation of an individual person against the rights of freedom of expression. In this case, this is a product disparagement case, where the only interest of the plaintiff involved is the interest of the reputation of its product, an interest which can hardly be said to be at the center of any decent system of ordered liberty. I would like to turn for a moment to back to the record, because the record makes it crystal clear that the district court found that Consumers Union acted in good faith, that it had no subjective awareness of falsity. Every attack on good faith was rejected by the district court. These included testimony by the plaintiff and cross-examination of the defendant, which took up a lengthy, substantial portion of the trial, contending that the author was biased against the Bose because of a competing patent which the author held. The district court specifically, on the basis of Mr. Seligson's demeanor, ruled out any bad faith on that ground. The district court likewise ruled out, again on the basis of Seligson's testimony, the charge made by the petitioner that he had fabricated other tests. The petitioner also charged that Consumers Union was biased towards low-priced products. The district court again ruled that out. Indeed, the district court specifically found that when the author had the opportunity to exercise subjective judgment in rating the Bose product, he upgraded the rating in the important area of sound quality, so that everything in the record is quite plain that there was no bad faith. The district court, in its finding of actual malice, did not point to any evidence, objective or subjective, from which actual malice could be either inferred directly or found directly. It did so, and it found actual malice only as a result of an erroneous application of a rule of law. And as this court has stated in Pullman Standard v. Swint, if a district court's findings rest on erroneous view of law, they may be set aside on that basis and are not subject to the restrictions of Rule 52. And the record is again clear, the district court opinion is plain, that the only reason for finding actual malice, the only reason articulated by the district judge, was that the author was too intelligent to have made an honest mistake. There was nothing else in the record, nothing else relied upon by the district court for its finding. It was that and that alone. And we believe that in doing so, the district court committed plain legal error. It inferred malice from falsity and applied an objective, reasonable person standard, which has been forbidden by this court, specifically in Garrison v. Louisiana, where the lower court, a state court there, had found actual malice because it said, "It is inconceivable to me that the defendant could have had a reasonable belief which could be defined as an honest belief that not one but all eight of these judges were guilty of what he charged them with. This court rejected that analysis, stating that this is not a holding applying the New York Times test. The reasonable belief standard applied by the trial judge is not the same as the reckless disregard of truth standard. The district court's holding, if allowed to stand, would in fact turn New York Times on its head. It would effectively impose strict liability upon responsible, conscientious publishers such as Consumers Union with hardworking, caring, intelligent writers and editors. It would render their carefully constructed editorial procedures designed to achieve accuracy irrelevant and meaningless. Indeed, by virtue of those very procedures, by virtue of the high standards of journalism which they embody, they would be ruled incapable of making an honest mistake and given no breathing space for honest error. Their words would be placed in the same legal category as which are placed the use of explosives, the harboring of dangerous animals, and forms of product liability. Our system of freedom of expression will surely not tolerate such a result. And the Court of Appeals recognized this erroneous misapplication of the law and faulted the district court for it, holding that to find actual malice in this case would be to interpret that concept to require little more than proof of falsity. We believe that holding is eminently correct.
If we disagree with you, would the issue of falsity be open in the Court of Appeals?
I believe so.
They just assumed. They didn't.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And they didn't, but they did reach the defamatory issue.
As dictum, as an aside, yes. They did
or
reach
disparagement.
It.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, they did. We believe that the district court, that the Court of Appeals, rather, acted properly. It did not engage in de novo fact-finding. Its role was limited solely to independently weighing the facts and determining whether, as applied to the Constitution, they met the clear and convincing proof standard. It seems to us that nothing could be more appropriate for a federal appellate court or this court to determine on undisputed facts what the Constitution means. We believe that even more so than the issue of fraud in the denaturalization proceedings before Justice Frankfurter in the Baumgartner case, that actual malice is a finding which cannot escape broadly social judgments, which is inextricably enmeshed with important fundamental rights. And as in Baumgartner, the burden of proof placed upon a plaintiff is to establish its case with convincing clarity. This constitutional requirement would be forfeit if a court of appeals could not exercise independent judgment. The net result would become that in First Amendment cases, in public figure defamation cases, for all practical purposes, the district court's finding on both factual and legal components would become impervious to review. That surely is not the intention. We believe that the Addington case is quite pertinent here. As pointed out there, the function of the legal process is to minimize the risk of an erroneous decision. By requiring proof of more than a mere preponderance, by calling upon a public figure libel plaintiff to establish actual malice with convincing clarity, the First Amendment has allocated the risk of error between the litigants. It is plainly recognized that the free speech and press rights at stake are more substantial than the loss of money.
Your time has expired now, counsel. Do you have anything further, Mr.
If Your Honor, please, Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. I'd like to answer your question, Mr. Justice Blackmun, about the Baumgartner case, which basically deals with an ultimate finding of fact there, which is really a conclusion of law or a mixed question of law and fact. And, of course, a court can always look at the evidence to see if there is enough evidence to be clear and convincing to the trier of fact. That is a question of law. Whether the trial court found it to be clear and convincing is a question of fact. And in the Woodby case at 385 U.S. 276, on page 367, this court pointed out, there is an elementary but crucial difference between burden of proof and scope of review. And that's, of course, commonplace in the law. Said the difference is most graphically illustrated in a criminal case. There, the prosecution must prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. But if the correct burden of proof was imposed at the trial, judicial review is generally limited to ascertaining whether the evidence relied upon by the trier of fact was of sufficient quality and substantiality to support the rationality of the judgment. In other words, an appellate court in a criminal case ordinarily does not ask itself whether it believes that the evidence at the trial established guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, but whether the judgment is supported by substantial evidence. We submit that the same type of review is appropriate here to determine whether the trial court could find by clear and convincing evidence that the statement was actually false. We don't agree with the characterization of the record by respondent here, but I believe that we have adequately covered it in our reply brief. I'd like really to kind of conclude here with what I feel is a very important aspect of this case, the proper allocation of business in the courts to trial courts and to appellate courts. The trial court's primary function is the finding of facts. The appellate court's primary function is rulings of law, to check what the trial court did to make sure that rulings of law have been followed. If appellate courts are going to independently reexamine facts, then an attorney who has lost a case has no alternative but to go up to the Court of Appeals and hope that he's going to get a new trial on the facts in the Court of Appeals. We submit that that is inappropriate, it's not conducive to justice, and would result in more appeals and less justice. Accordingly, we submit that the decision of the Court of Appeals should be reversed here, the judgment of liability of the trial court affirmed, and the Court of Appeals instructed to review the question of damages in accordance with the clearly erroneous rule. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.
Can I help you down, please?